The following recording is offered by the Village Zendo. For more information, please visit villagezendo.org.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome. It's very nice to be with you here tonight. Special welcome to those who are new, who I don't know. My name is Shinryu. And some of you are just coming in now. Others of you had a couple of periods to sit. So just to take a minute and notice where we're at and where our mind is at. All day long we've been stirring up dust and we don't even know it, and then we come in here and the first thing is just sitting still and not following our train of thought the way we do all day long, just trying to let go of the thoughts for a minute and be present and connect with our bodies. All of a sudden we can start to see all that dust that's swirling around in our minds. And maybe after a period, or maybe after a couple of periods, it starts to settle down a little bit. And we can start to see a little more clearly, because it's not all filtered through all of that swirling dust. During this recent study period at the Village Zendo, we were working with a text called the Vimalakirti Sutra. And I believe Roshi asked us to continue working with this text in the fall, so I'm gonna refer to that a little bit. It's an old text. The origin of it is a little obscure, but we know that it emerged quite early in China with the development of Buddhism in China. And it focuses on a man named Vimalakirti, who was a lay person, like most of us, who had a family and was a merchant and hung out in taverns and brothels and the streets. But he had a very clear eye, a very profound insight. And in the sutra, he is ill and in his sick bed, and he's visited by all of the bodhisattvas, the great enlightened and enlightening beings, who go to meet him and to witness a dialogue between Vimalakirti and the great bodhisattva of wisdom, Manjusri. And this is maybe the highlight of the whole text, is their dialogue. And Vimalakirti, in his sick bed, asks the assembly, how does the bodhisattva enter the gate of non-duality? How does a bodhisattva, an enlightening being, enter the gate of non-duality? This is a question for each one of us, actually. How do we enter the gate of non-duality? And what transpires is all of these different bodhisattvas who are present in the room give their views on the matter. Many very profound and subtle answers to Vimalakirti's question. And I wrote down one of them here just as a sample. One whose name is Bodhisattva Delight in Truth says, the true and the not true form a dualism. But one who sees truly cannot even see the true. So how can he see the untrue? Why? Because they cannot be seen by the physical eye. Only the eye of wisdom can see them. But for this eye of wisdom, there is no seeing and no not seeing. In this way, one may enter the gate of non-dualism. Okay, so all of these bodhisattvas give similar kinds of answers, very philosophically intriguing, and but ultimately they're just really dualistic answers to the question, and they're caught up in all sorts of ideas and language about what non-duality is. And so they fall short, really. And then the bodhisattvas turn to Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, and say, tell us, Manjushri, how do you see it? How does the bodhisattva enter the gate of non-duality? And Manjushri replies, to my way of thinking, all dharmas are without words, without explanations, without purport, without cognition, removed from all questions and answers. In this way, one may enter the gate of non-dualism. Mm-hmm. So Manjushri comes at the whole thing from a different angle. And it's really the angle of the Buddhist teachings of Prajnaparamita, the wisdom teachings, which essentially say that no things have any intrinsic substance because everything is subject to change and everything is dependent on everything else. There is no intrinsic identity or condition. And therefore, we cannot rely on words and ideas to capture reality, the fundamental reality. So that's the move that Manjushri makes. And then Manjushri turns to Vimalakirti and he says to him, so now I pose the question to you. How does the bodhisattva enter the gate of non-duality? And Vimalakirti's response is, Vimalakirti is silent, and he uses no words, and he generates no concepts about it. He just manifests it. How does the bodhisattva enter the gate of non-duality? He doesn't tell. So this is a famous story, and it's very appreciated in the Zen tradition. It's in a couple of the major koan collections that we use to study with. It's in the Blue Cliff Record. It's in the Book of Serenity. And I assume that one of the reasons why this is so appreciated is because Vimalakirti is basically doing what you were doing a few minutes ago. He just is quiet, and he sits there or lies there in his sick bed, and he lets go of his thoughts, and he doesn't rely on language, and he just engages with reality as it is right now in this moment. So that's what we're about here at the Zen Center, is first and foremost just sitting. Master Dogen, I think it's in the Bendawa, says, he's asked, why do you emphasize the sitting silent meditation so much? And he says, it's because it's the principal gate. And I think it's really the same thing that Vimalakirti is teaching, in a very direct way. to shift gears a little bit here and share a little study that I've been doing on my own. It's a little bit on the scholarly side, a little bit heady, so I apologize for that, but hopefully there's something in it for us and from a practice perspective. I've been reading a little bit about a debate that was happening in what's in the field of critical Buddhism. This is some debate that goes back now some 20 years or more, but a couple of scholars in Japan were particularly important in this debate. Hakamaya and Matsumoto are their names. And this is all new to me, and I really don't have a strong grasp of it, but I thought I would share it with you, because I think it's relevant for us. They are very polemical and deliberately provocative. And what they've said, basically, baldly put, and they're pretty bald about it themselves, is that Zen, as it's evolved, isn't real Buddhism. Japanese Zen isn't really Buddhism. Chinese Zen, Chan, isn't really Buddhism. What do they mean by that, and why do they say that? Well, they argue that Buddhism originally, the original teaching is what I was referring to before, the basic teaching of emptiness. And the basic teaching of emptiness is that there's no, all things are empty of any intrinsic nature. This cup is empty of any intrinsic nature. And you and you and you and you and me, we're all empty of any intrinsic nature. Why? Because we're constantly changing, and because we're constantly shaped by everything else around us. In other words, everything is impermanent and everything is interdependent. And in that sense, it's fundamentally empty. So there's no essential identity that anything has. And the reason they object to some of the thinking in Chinese and Japanese Zen is has to do with certain concepts which emerged and became quite important, and which actually are part of our common parlance around here in the Zendo and in the Dharma talks. But for example, one concept that is kind of technical but influential is the category of Tathagata Garbha. Tathagata means the thus come one. It refers to Buddha. And Garbha means womb or embryo. So the idea of Tathagata Garbha is that there is a Buddha, fundamental Buddha nature, a fundamental Buddha essence or potentiality that all things have and that each one of us has. And the problem is that because of our agitated lives and all of the conditioning we're subject to and all the delusions that arise as a result of that, we lose touch with our true nature, and our Buddha, our potential as Buddhas. And if we can really, through practice, purify and clarify, that true nature can come through. So other ideas connected with Tathagata Garbha would be like true nature or Buddha nature. These are concepts that they do not like, they think are not Buddhist. Original enlightenment is something they really attack. In Japanese, it's Hongaku Shiso. Original enlightenment. It's the same idea that all things have an original, pure nature that then gets sullied and tarnished by delusions, but through practice can be revealed and manifest. So what they object to is the idea that there's actually, they're saying original Buddhist thinking is there's no self. But here the Chinese and the Japanese have essentially snuck in these concepts of self, which is what original Buddhism was opposed to. The original Buddhism was opposed to Indian philosophical ideas of an Atman, a self. And here it's been smuggled back in again as Buddha nature, true nature, original enlightenment. And so it's these ideas that there's some kind of underlying substrate or ground of being, if you will, that everything shares in, that everything is a part of. It's a monistic, a notion of total unity of all things, which relies on some fundamental essence. And they're saying this is really problematic, and philosophically and doctrinally, and so that's a whole problem that they've got. And I think it's something that we should look at, because we do use these ideas and we do use this language all the time. So what's up with that? That's not what I want to talk about more tonight. It's kind of complicated. So maybe I'll come back to that in another talk. But I want to talk about another problem that comes out of this first problem for them, for these critical Buddhism thinkers. And that is, they say, isn't just a philosophical problem, it's a social and political and ethical problem. Because this kind of thinking about original enlightenment and true nature and Buddha nature has a very reactionary and problematic effect. Why? Because it encourages us to think that things are perfect, whole, and complete just as they are. And this is the perfect ideology to legitimate and justify forms of social injustice, hierarchy, and violence in the world. If we think it's all hunky-dory because it's all, you know, Buddha nature, all of a sudden we're down with all the social injustice, exploitation, and violence in the world. That's a big problem. And they argue that from the medieval period in Japan, this kind of thinking has justified the status quo and been used by kings and aristocrats and authorities in all sorts of ways that are reproduce social injustice. So they say, for example, it also reinforces a sense that Japanese culture is beyond criticism and beyond reform. And that has been used by nationalists and as a kind of ethnocentric agenda to support Japanese military aggression in the late 19th and early 20th century, and then leading into World War II. This kind of thinking has been the ideological basis for Japanese authoritarianism and military aggression, and also for forms of social exclusion within Japan. For example, the mistreatment of Koreans, Chinese, and other immigrants who've come into Japan as laborers and who've not received the rights of the legal and political rights of citizens who have not received social and economic rights, who've been marginalized and excluded, as well as those traditional sectors within Japanese society that have been stigmatized as being of inferior caste because they're involved in certain trades and professions which are looked down upon as dirty, impure. So outcasts in Japanese society have also been the victims of this kind of policies based on this kind of ideology. Okay. So I think this is something that we need to look at as well. Does our practice and the kinds of concepts that we have in our community, does it serve as a way to justify the status quo? Do we think that sitting on the cushion and being silent is really everything that our practice is about? You can just sit there and keep your mouth shut and that's where it's at. If so, it would be problematic. I think that we do, part of the teaching here is about seeing reality as it is, and in a sense, accepting reality as it is. So rather than automatically and reflexively reacting to it. So we, for example, we have three tenets that we refer to often that are connected with the three pure precepts in our tradition, the White Plum tradition. The three pure precepts are ceasing from evil, doing good, and doing good for others. And we think about these things in a kind of novel way that our teachers have come up with, Bernie Glassman, Enkyo Roshi here. Starting from a standpoint of not knowing, we say can be seen as a way of ceasing from evil, not knowing. In other words, setting aside all of our preconceived judgments and all of our prejudices and all the ideas, our narrow ideas that we carry around during the course of the day. Just to put them aside for a minute and try to see things as they really are rather than as we are predisposed to think they are, would be not knowing. And doing good, according to the second tenet, would be bearing witness. So once you can put aside your preconceived judgments and just see things as they are, bear witness to the joy and suffering in the world, that would be doing good. So we come back to these ideas over and over again as key aspects of our practice. But if it stopped there, then our practice would really be quite incomplete. And so we have the third tenet to go along with the idea of doing good for others as action that is based upon the first two. Action that's based upon not knowing, that's based on bearing witness, or compassionate action that flows from not knowing and bearing witness. So that's a key component, I think, for us, without which everything else would really be incomplete and would be quite problematic. But if we are able to let go of our ideas for a period of two sitting and open up to what's really happening right now, observing and bearing witness to the suffering in the world, and then responding appropriately based on what we find in front of us. Hopefully we can act in a way that's a little more skillful and a little more helpful for ourselves and others, rather than just reproducing the cycles of suffering. So I think if we include that as part of our practice, then we aren't so stuck in the problem that Hakamai and Matsumoto identify. There's been a lot of, and I think this is an aspect that's also been present within Buddhism over the centuries too. There are so many examples of practitioners, lay or ordained, who really try to serve in the world based on their practice. But in this country too, there's been a real energy around trying to make Zen practice or Buddhist practice socially engaged in a way that can be helping to serve and not just to get along in a world that's in flames, but to try to do something to be a benefit. So social engagement can take a lot of different ways, but the point, I think, is that our practice starts with sitting down on the cushion and putting aside our thoughts and just being quiet for a bit. But it doesn't end there. And so after a period or two periods, it's time to rise up. It's time to go out the door. It's time to merge with everybody else out on the street. And there are many, many ways in which our practice can engage with what's going on in the world in a time of such tumult and so much suffering and so much in such incendiary times, literally incendiary. So tomorrow, for example, there's a climate strike. I don't know what you have planned, but you might want to go down to Foley Square at 12 o'clock. People are going to be assembling. 1 o'clock, there's a march down to Battery Park. There's a rally at 3:30 to try to bring attention to the climate conditions and generate some pressure around environmental issues today in conjunction with the summit that's going on, the climate summit that's going on at the UN. And I'll get to you at the end of the evening. Other things too, the following Saturday we've got a climate and contemplation event that Enkyo Roshi is going to be leading at Governor's Island. It'll be a very nice day of walking around Governor's Island, doing some bird watching. There'll be some presentations on science and the environment, as well as the Dharma. Sunday, the 29th, I believe it is, there's a Village Zendo social action meeting. So come out for that if you'd like to get involved, if there are issues that you'd like to work on, suggestions that you have. Village Zendo has been doing a lot of work around criminal justice and prison reform. And I think this meeting will be taking stock of what we're doing and what new directions we might want to go in. So That would be a great opportunity for you as well. So I'll just end. Sitting on the cushion is an opportunity to, like Vimalakirti, to manifest non-duality. But marching and chanting and attending a committee meeting can also be opportunities for practicing non-duality. And listening to the bells and chanting the four vows now is another way of entering the gate of non-duality. Thank you.